This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shane Gallagher and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I am in Toronto at the Toronto Metro Centre at SIGC, the Conference of Computing Education. And I'm joined by Dr. Samaranda.
Yes.
Sandhu, who is an instructor in the Science Laboratory, we'll talk about what that is, in Wellesley College. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I forgot to ask where Wellesley is.
Oh, it's in, funnily enough, Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in Romania. Pretty far out.
That's a pretty long way away.
That is true.
From Massachusetts.
Yes.
When did you move across?
I came for college. So Wellesley is actually my alma mater. So at 19, when I graduated high school, I came to Wellesley. And I left for a while to do my grad school. I was in Ithaca. And now I'm back.
Cool. What did you want to be when you grew up?
I don't know. I think, so I'm from Romania, Eastern Europe. So it's a lot of like study and math and theory. And I was very into that when I was a kid. And I think I remember telling my mom at some point, like, I don't see myself not doing math. But I don't think I had the kind of ability to think far in advance to be like, well, what am I going to do with it? So I never thought, I think, too much about careers until I came to the States and everybody was like, I need this because I'm going to do XYZ after. And I was like, wait a minute. I haven't thought things through. So.
What attracted you to that maths direction?
I like problem solving a lot. And I think, for me, mathematics was a lot about creativity and curiosity and kind of about losing yourself in the problem solving almost, and finding patterns. And yeah, for me, the theory was not kind of it was like a challenge. It was something that you had to kind of like find your way through. And the more abstract, the better.
So you found yourself to Wellesley?
Yes.
With an idea to do maths?
Well, kind of. High school was, I think for everybody, a stressful experience. And I think towards the latter part of my high school life, once I kind of decided, no, I will try to leave Romania and try to get my college degree somewhere else, it felt very isolating, and it felt like I didn't have who to talk to. And so I think my relationship with math, for a number of reasons, but I think one of them being that, kind of got a little strained. So when I got to Wellesley, I was very much buying into the, you know, college is about trying new things and new experiences. And so I tried CS. I took CS 111, so our intro CS course the first semester. But then I kind of like felt guilty about forgetting about math. Like, I had like some I was mad at it, but I didn't want to let it go. It sounds like a bad relationship, but so I took some classes, and again, it was mostly inertia. The first class wasn't great, the second class was bad. I was like, I'm just gonna drop this. I tried, it didn't work. And then the third one was beautiful and amazing, and I was like, nope, that's back for me. So, yeah.
And you stuck with that?
I did. I still pursued CS. And I think as I took more and more classes, I realized that what I liked about CS was the theoretical part. I liked the abstraction. I liked the theory of computation course, the algorithms, the cryptography, like those things where you use the math and you, yeah, again, go deep to see what that does in the computer science field. But I did discover, yeah, math is the thing that I want to kind of keep doing, and kept taking more and more. And yeah, folks were like, so you're doing grad school, right? And I was like, I guess I am. Again, inertia. And yeah, I stuck with it. And so my grad school was in mathematics. But as time went on, again, something that I discovered, and I don't know if there's papers on this out there, but a lot of, like, I valued math and I valued CS, but I ended up going something very, what I think is interdisciplinary, so kind of at the intersection of logic, game theory, computer science, so a lot of these different perspectives. And I think folks from, ooh, a raccoon. Sorry. I'm like the dog from Up. That's a pretty big raccoon.
Isn't it?
You know what? That's pretty high for it, isn't it?
I'm sure they know how to climb.
That's fair. All right.
So what was your doctorate on? Will I understand it?
Oh, I can try. So it was it was basically logic. It was this idea, it was looking very in-depth at these things called counterfactuals. And counterfactuals are statements like, so conditional statements, right? Like if X, then Y. But where you know that the thing that comes after the if is false. So it's something like, if I were in Paris right now, I would eat a lot of croissants. They don't all have to have that. I think it's called subjunctive, like that time tense for the verb. But they're all about this idea that you know that the antecedent, what it's called, is false. So then how can you reason about that kind of a statement? And it turns out that those statements are uttered all the time when we kind of argue for the decisions we make. And so they end up being used a lot in game theory and logic to think about equilibria situations. So it was really an in-depth look at how counterfactuals help us understand rationality for people. And again, these are very theoretical games, so it was a very abstract kind of situation, but it was the logic of these counterfactuals. I don't know if that made any sense.
Cool. I think we're going to come back to that in a bit. But we're going to have your first song first. Martin Phipps, Look Up. Why this one?
Why this one? I was listening to it on repeat during pandemic. And yeah, I don't know if this is true for other folks, but I have once I listen to something enough, the next time I listen to it, I get like flashbacks of what happened. And so now whenever I listen to that song, I have this vision of like snow falling and like my apartment where I was during the pandemic and that like idea of isolation. So, yeah.
Thank you.
were listening to that, snow, isolation. Is that your story of the pandemic?
It's a lot of it, because at the time I was in Ithaca, New York, which is... God, I'm still a Romanian at heart. I don't know. It's like central New York, central... It's by the Finger Lakes, if that helps anybody. But it has a lot of snow. Not Buffalo, New York amounts of snow, but like a lot of snow. And it was... I'm risk averse, partly because I'm Romanian, but partly I think I'm just a risk averse human. And so I think the pandemic was really tough. And so I think isolation and snow actually do, resonate a lot with that period.
Were you teaching?
I was teaching online. That was also very isolating. I remember this one time where everybody had their cameras off and I had to talk about something and it was like 5 minutes. And by the end, I felt like crying because nobody said anything. Nobody did anything. And I was like, okay, I'm sending you off into your break rooms. Good luck. I can't. It's as if I'm not here. So that was rough. That was rough. But it was also... weird because like I didn't feel like I could go in person, even though I knew I think people who tried to do hybrid, especially later in the beginning, everybody was on Zoom, I think. But it was a very, very strange time to be doing anything, but definitely teaching, whatever that was.
Do you think it changed the I know it changed the experience in the small for those learners, but did it change their educational experience?
I think so. It's, I don't know, school wasn't that long ago for me, so it feels like if I weren't able to, I don't know, connection and community was something that was huge for my college and even the beginning of my grad school years. And if I didn't have that, I think I would, the feeling of not belonging, which I think affects a lot of people, feeling isolated, feeling troubled. I think all of these get augmented, and it's a troubling time. Like, you gotta figure out your life, you gotta find a job, and you gotta do all these kind of like alone.
When you went back to, when the students went back to class and you went back to class, did it feel like a release?
So, funnily enough, I didn't go back to class at Cornell. So the first time I taught back in person was at Wellesley, and it did feel almost this like, joining of forces. We're back together. We have a responsibility to do this right. maybe valuing things that we'd been taking for granted, but yeah, I don't know. Again, I'm risk averse. So I don't know how much of a release it felt like, because everybody was still wearing masks. Everybody was still, like, tiptoeing around things. Which, I don't know. I think being careful is a positive thing that I'd like us to take out of this, and being mindful of other people's lives and preferences. I don't know if that's what it felt like for everybody.
And it's the pandemic... has dragged on and on.
It is, yeah. It's here, right?
Have we reached a new normal?
Gosh, I remember at Cornell when they sent us emails about the new normal back in, like, I think it was like 2021, and I was like, no, this this can't be it. I think people are really attached to the word normal. I don't know if, I think many are it's my perception. I don't know if that's true, but it feels like so many people are like, no, I want us to go back to that, even over learning stuff from what's happened in the past 3 years by now. But I think we've reached, I don't know, an equilibrium. Yeah.
One of the things that we noticed during the pandemic was a lot of people were arguing for that new normal and were desperate to get back to that new normal and wanted a timetable for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Asking the government, you know, exactly what date will the border be reopened?
Right. Yeah.
Despite the fact that it was a fluid, complex system for which that was impossible.
Right.
But people really needed that certainty or were looking for that certainty.
Yeah.
Do you think we can somehow train people to be more comfortable with the uncertainty?
I think it's a skill. It's like a thing that you practice because it's uncomfortable. And I think it takes a little bit of comfort and feeling like I know who I am, I'm safe with who I am, and I'm safe with what I do. And so, yeah, it's okay if something takes, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 years. And there's some luxury in there, like I can afford to do whatever, X, Y, Z, like I can afford. There's things about like childcare and all of these things that I was fortunate enough to not worry about. But I know I had friends who were really struggling. But I think there's some value in having practice with like discomfort, and that uncertainty, it would be good for us to kind of practice. That's something that I'm noticing now, I mean, in myself, but also in some of my students who are very wary of any kind of discomfort. And some of it is this timeline thing. They want some things to be like very clearly delineated. And it's kind of hard to be like, no, you know, it's like an upper level course. You got to figure some stuff out. But I think that discomfort is hard to stay in.
I used to have a picture on my office wall that said my comfort zone. And then outside the comfort zone, where the interesting stuff happens.
Yeah.
How do we get people beyond the comfort zone to those sorts of points where that transformational learning can happen without putting them under too much risk and keeping them safe?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no point making someone feel miserable. So how do we do that in a positive way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I think community might be the answer. If you're feeling like the community has your back and you're safe to say, you know, no, and you're safe to also say yes, like, yes, I want to try this, or no, I don't want to try this. So finding a group where you feel like you belong and you feel like you're welcome to explore. That was one of the things I liked about Wellesley when I was a student. It really felt like everybody was met where they were. And I know that's definitely not everybody's experience at the time. But for me, it felt like I can be who I am and I can even explore other things about myself and what I'd like to do. And that was very liberating because it felt like that comfort zone was a little like fluid. It wasn't like this, you know, hard boundary that you had to fight your way through. It was like, I can go out and come back in and kind of, have an adventure and then come back into, they were calling it then, and I think they're still calling it now, like the Wellesley bubble. But it was a safe space. And I think, again, that can be the answer. Like, have a community where you're like, okay, this is safe. I feel like you get accountability, you get respect, you get support, and you get people sometimes being like, no, you got to keep a deadline, you got to go do the thing. which can feel sometimes like going out of your comfort zone. But yeah.
What was the relationship between the national sort of communication of what had to happen and the regional and local communication? You said that people referred to a Wellesley bubble. Was that a sort of a local, you know, how we're looking after ourselves as a community messaging?
I think that was, the Wellesley bubble part was back when I was a student. And I think it was mostly, Wellesley is like 13 miles away from Boston, and it's like a suburban town in Massachusetts, and it's far enough that like to get out you need either a car or a train or a bus. Like, it's hard to get out to Boston, even though it's like only 13 miles. And inside you have more or less tried like everything you might want. Like, you have food, the basic necessities, right? You have a dorm, you have food, not a lot of entertainment, but there's a lot of like orgs and whatever. So a few of your needs are met. And you are, I think the bubble comes a little bit from the protection that you are supposed to feel. Again, I felt, that's definitely not what everybody else felt. One, in terms of safety, so All Women's College, but also in terms of, and even that has some important kind of like connotations, like what does it mean to be safe? Anyway, but also in terms of like support, like at school, in your relationships, all of that stuff. So that was, I think, the bubble. I don't know if they're still calling it a bubble. That would be interesting to know. In terms of like COVID response, like I can talk about that, but that was very much like, while I was at Cornell. And so there was the kind of Cornell response, there was the New York State response, and then there was the whole US response. And things were in length and things were battling each other at the same time. It was confusing. It was stressful to read the news. It was stressful to not read the news. I was during that time in the States. My sister was in the UK. My parents are still in Romania. And it was fascinating to kind of keep in touch throughout this whole thing and kind of listen to each kind of government response and each local response and how waves would propagate either right from east or up west all the way here or the other way around.
What was the, I know you weren't there, but I presume you heard about it. What was the messaging in Romania? How did that community respond?
I think from what I heard from my parents, it was confusing there too. So I think sometimes they managed to like rally and say, no, you really need like vaccines. And other times it felt like people had like lost all hope and lost all trust in medicine and news, and there was no way of convincing anybody of anything. That I think is not uncommon in Romania. There's a lot of corruption you kind of just grow up with and grow up around. But I think, as far as I understand now, the biggest problem that my folks are telling me is that it's led to this, just like, people just don't believe, not just the media, but people don't believe doctors anymore. And that, I think, is a problem.
That's interesting, because I was about to say, coming from a country that has had higher levels of distrust and corruption and things, are they more prepared for dealing with the waves of fake news?
No, I mean, I think one of the things that Romania is currently dealing with, and again, I don't live there, but I think there's a lot of people who... So the education system, we're back to education. It's the education system has kind of like gone way, way down. So people go to school, but they don't take the skills. So they graduate, but, you know, they get a piece of text and they can read it. Like they can read word after word, but they don't understand anything. And I think that's getting to be a really large proportion of the population. And so that ends up being a population that's easily manipulable. And, easily, like, this idea of, like, fake news can easily be, like, thrown around. And I think something that we're seeing a little bit in other places, too, is how that augments this whole, like, nationalist, drive. I don't know. It's a very strange space.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nane aroha nui kia koutou, ko tahoho. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars, in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding. Very sustaining and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and we've had to develop so many new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling. We've had to really pull upon all our internal and external resources to navigate our way through these very challenging times. And it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the compassion, the time, the care, the understanding, the love, the support that we all so richly deserve and are capable of giving and receiving. What a precious gift. It really is a fascinating time to be alive. And of course, for so much of our lives, really, we were moving in so many ways on automatic pilot. And the last few years have awoken us, and we've had to really recalibrate and reintegrate so many new levels of awareness in order to make our way through. And of course, we find ourselves now in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in a way returning to the ways of life that we previously knew. But of course, everything is so different and changed, and we are so different and changed. And so, of course, we can have a great sense of return and homecoming and familiarity and contentment, and we can feel so happy that things are the way that they were for the majority of our lives. But also, this is really informed by a sense that things can change, things can very radically change. And it's so important to know that we have made it through, we can make it through again, really whatever happens. In many ways it's been a great leveler, but also a great level upper, that we know we can triumph despite things looking quite different and feeling quite different each day. I know for myself, it's been wonderful this term because we've been fully booked. So we've had lots of beautiful people coming to visit us every single day at Orokinui Eco Sanctuary, my heart's home. And it's been a great mix from beautiful early childhood visitors to university and polytech product design students thinking about how they can help us with our nesting boxes and our bird feeders and interpretive displays and all sorts of things. And, you know, of course, every day visitors now from all over the world. So hearing not only stories from our local rohe, but stories from people all over the world who have been prevented from visiting and now are free to visit and reconnect with us, which is wonderful. And myself and my band have started playing again, which is wonderful, and we've been playing lots of events and festivals, and we're now playing Feastock, which is a very wonderful and precious festival in our community, and we'll be playing second to last on the evening, which is very special. We're also the final band ever to play at Dog With Two Tails, which is a very beloved venue which has had to close. And so really it's an interesting time of some things starting again and other things fading away, having to be reborn, reformed. Tomorrow we'll be having a jam, trying out some new song ideas. So of course I'm very grateful for this, but I also feel quite nervous about it. But I know for all of us that this time has inspired and has created new ideas and new stories. And so part of what we have to do, of course, is share them and let them out into the world. And this is what we're all doing in different ways at this time. So I really hope for you, you're getting the support and the love that you need. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Smiranda Sandhu. I met you yesterday at a special session, a workshop on, I've forgotten what it's called, Computing for Good, something
yeah,
like that. What brought you along to that?
I went to a session on the same topic last year, and it was kind of a workshop. So the main point was to connect with other people who seem to think that this is something we should keep doing, so involving computing for social good topics within our curriculum, and doing something, so like actively thinking about how can your assignment change. And I liked, one, the focus on community, two, the focus on you're here, we want you to like take the most of this time, I want you to like do something by the end. I feel like oftentimes you go to these and people just talk at you, and I understand why my students right have eyes glazed over after I talk at them, so I really liked that, and I like the emphasis on like no act is too small, like any change that you do towards this is valuable, because you might have, it's possible that you might have one other student who is like, oh, I didn't know that, that's cool, I would like to become a computer scientist. And I think at the end of the day, you really cater to one student. I don't know, like, in my most pessimist days, I feel like if I'm there in the front of the classroom or not, it doesn't really matter. but in my optimist days, I'm like, okay, there's one student in the class that I feel like I could make a difference for. So that's, I think, something that really attracted me at that workshop. And so when I heard that they're doing this activity for this one, I was like, yep, sign me up.
So you're teaching at, is it liberal arts?
Yes.
And do you say it's women's only?
Yes. We're having, as everybody, we have to explore what that means right now. And I think it's a very stressful time for Wellesley College. We haven't figured out what that means, I think, but...
One of the premises of the Computing for Good movement is that if we just treat computing as a mechanical tool or an abstract theoretical tool, we're losing half the people, especially the women from class. Mm. And that if we describe, we can still describe the techniques of computing, the list sorting or whatever it might be, in more social terms, we're actually better engaging with people. Are you noticing that with your students?
Yeah, I think so. We try to include ethics or social computing or topics like that in our intro courses. And students seem to really connect with that. And they seem to really... I think for some students, they literally like come alive. Like in all the other sessions, it feels almost like a different persona. and that's, yeah, I don't, so that makes me feel like, okay, we're not doing a great job of it, but we should keep trying and we should keep working on it, and hopefully that'll that'll be better than doing nothing. But yeah, I don't think we figured out the best way to do it. But yeah, again, for some people, it really feels like, you know, they're sleeping more or less, or again, inertia. And then for this one class, it's like, yes, I'm here. I feel like I can contribute.
Because you came into computing not really caring where you went with it.
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't sound that good now, does it? I did some computer science in Romania because theory, you got to do the things. But it never felt like, it was fun. It was problem solving, but it didn't feel like, yes, this is what I'm going to do. And starting computer science at Wellesley, that was when I was like, oh, wait, I could be a computer scientist. That soon evolved as I took more math. But yeah, I think part of it is I had some of the luxury in not having to think about whether what I do, I don't know, like I see some of my students who are saying, I need to graduate in 3 years, or I need to figure this out quickly because I, you know, have to send money back home. All of these things that I think are very stressful, especially on someone who's like 17, 18. And I didn't have to do that. I had this freedom to say, I'm in this because this is interesting, and I'll explore it, and I'll see where it goes. And I think that really connects back to what I liked about math, the curiosity, the when you can engage with something from only that perspective, I think it can be liberating. Yeah.
How do we encourage that curiosity?
Not by telling them to be curious. That doesn't work. Yeah. I think some things that have worked have been going back to that motivation aspect. So finding the things that are like, oh, I want to do X in my community, or I feel like this is something that's very important, and they're curious about that. And so kind of the CS or the math or the physics or whatever is almost like a side project. Like, you just have to learn it to get there. And whether that stays or whether that changes, to some extent, that I don't know if that matters. But I think that the curiosity is the thing that has to be stoked. And I kind of like that word because it is kind of like a fire. Like, if you're trying to get an answer for a question that you really care about, like, you will, I don't know, do anything. You won't feel like there's kind of limitations and things stopping you. This reminds me of this thing where, like, there's this guy who's a motivational speaker, but he was saying that our minds can't think in the negative. So if I tell you don't think about an elephant, you're going to think about an elephant. And so if you're thinking about how to get somewhere, but don't look at, I don't know, X, right? You're only going to see X all the way. But if you're focused on, like, the goal and the curiosity and the questions and all of that, everything else kind of like, okay, I have to do this first, and okay, I have to do this next. So that would be nice. How do we do it? I don't know.
Let's have some music instead then. Let's have your second music choice, Adina Menzel and Christina Chenoweth. For good. Why this one?
I love musicals. I love them so much. I think they're a good blend of music and life. I don't know. It's... and this is about friendship, about starting over, but keeping the past as a fuel. I don't know, it's about being grateful. It's a good one to come back to.
Just look at me. I'm limited, and just look at you, you can do all I couldn't do, Linda. So now it's up to you. Something we must learn, and we are led to those who help us most grow if we let them, and we help them in return. Well, I don't know if I believe that's true, but I know I'm who I am today because I knew you. Like a comet pulled from orbit as it passes a sun, like a stream that meets a boulder halfway through the wood, who can say if I've been changed for the better? I knew you. I have been changed for good. It well may be that we will never meet again in this lifetime. So let me say before we part, so much of me is made of what I learned from you. You'll be with me like a handprint on my heart. And now whatever way our stories end, I know you have rewritten mine by being my friend. Like a ship blown from its mooring by a wind off the sea, like a sea dropped by a sky bird in a distant world, who can say if I've been changed for the better? But because I knew you, because I knew you, I have been changed for good. Just to clear the air, I ask forgiveness for the things I've done you blame me for. But then I guess we know there's blame to share, and none of it seems to matter anymore.
We've seen lots of changes in the last, I have to say, 3 years now.
I know, right?
we used to ask people on the show, we used to say, what do you think is going to stick and what do you hope will stick?
Mm.
But now I'm wondering if the things that are going to stick have already stuck.
Yeah.
So let's go back and pretend it was a year or two ago. What were you hoping would stick? And have we seen that stick?
Mm. I think I was hoping for the care for the other. I was hoping that that would stick. And I think it was really a good time for people with certain disabilities. It felt to me like suddenly a different kind of attention was being given. And I was hoping that care for the other would stick. I don't know if that stuck. It feels like, and moving to back, whatever back means, it feels like we're kind of putting that on the wayside, backside, I don't know the right English expression for it. I was hoping, I don't know, it was a strange time. I was hoping some kind of attention to science would stick, but that was confusing. Like, that was, I don't know. Communication was not great. So maybe something that I would like to stick, but would be this idea that communicating science is, I don't know, the pessimist. It's like even more important than the science. Because like if you're doing a bad job, like it doesn't matter how good it is. Mm. And catering to, sorry, interrupting. Catering to your audience. Like if you don't know who your audience is.
Maybe there's been an increased understanding in the process of science.
Mm.
That sort of, that response that when the recommendations changed, mm. you said, but 2 months ago you said this, and we said, yeah.
Right.
Now we know this different thing.
Right.
And people seeing that as, see, you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
But that forced science to have to explain.
Yeah.
That is the process of science.
Right.
But we go through that. I wonder if that is going to have a bit of an impact, that people will start to understand that as a process more.
Yeah. And I think that's partly, I would like that. I think that's partly part of, still maybe part of the communication. I don't know. Sometimes it feels like science, similar like computer science, like, oh, the computer did it. Or, you know, X happened. Rather than thinking there's a process, who's involved in the process, how does the process go, and why does that matter to me? Like, for me, who is, I don't know, given a random human somewhere, like, why do I care about what the scientific process is like? And it ends up, like, it is matter. Like, we're all connected, so it does matter. But I think that's an important part of, like, explaining it and bringing it to people, rather than making it this, like, elitist thing that only a small number of people should care about. Like, don't worry your pretty little mind. Like, we got it. It would be nice if that stuck. I don't know. I teach at a liberal arts school. I'm, like, surrounded by academia. I need to get out. So I don't know if that's changed at all, but
I have some questions to end the show, and not very much time, so we're going to have to wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh my God, that's so big. Oh God, biggest success. This is so hard. I think coming back to Wellesley and coming to teach at Wellesley. I don't know, there's so many things, from little things, like, you know, I'm still here. That's a big success. To, again, graduating. Grad school was not a good time. And Wellesley. yeah, to teaching a course of theory and, you know, not crashing and burning. Yeah. I can't pick one.
They all sound good.
Thank you.
What's your superpower?
Superpower. I worry well. I worry really well. But that ends up being that I'm a good planner. So.
So if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
Gosh. I would... I would like everybody to be able to talk to each other better. Like, really open-ended, non-judgmental, like, meeting the other person where they are. Yeah, ground-shattering talking. Like, yeah, those kinds of, yeah, talks that you remember. I'd like it if we could all do that.
What's the smallest thing that we could do that would have the biggest impact in that direction?
I think being curious about the other person and less self-focused. Yeah, less worried about, oh, how does this affect me? And more, yeah, what about this person? Yeah, who are they? How can I help them? How can they help me, maybe? Like, I don't know. It doesn't... I don't know. I'm not saying that everybody should be 200% altruistic. Like, sometimes you got to take care of yourself. But, yeah, curiosity. That's my jam, curiosity.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I don't... I think I'd like to be, but I don't think I am. I don't know. I think one of the reasons I was excited to come back to Wellesley was, like, I feel like this is a place where change can happen and where people who have been marginalized can be protected and safe and literally, yeah, be the leaders of tomorrow. So I feel like that is a space where groundbreaking things can happen. But I don't think I'm there yet.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
That I can get to that goal. Like, yeah. Yeah, that maybe this current student that I'm talking to can see that they have way more potential than the world has told them they can. And, yeah, they can do it, anything. So maybe today will be the day when I convince that student. But who knows?
So what's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I am excited to look into more research opportunities, like... Again, grad school was really tough for me, and I was training to be a mathematician, so research was very different. So when I kind of switched to teach computer science, it doesn't feel like a career switch, maybe when I say it, but it was a little bit. And so thinking of, like, what is my space here? What is my role here? What can I do? And, yeah, I'm excited to try some CS Ed research thingies.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Advice. I mean, I can go with my theme for today, it seems, which was be curious. And I think that comes with being open, being non-judgmental, and being curious about yourself. That's definitely something that the pandemic has shown me a lot about myself and what limitations I'd put on myself. But yeah, and that doesn't mean not thinking about things or not having thoughts. right, but being curious and open and kind of like the water, right? Like being fluid and then you can do anything.
Thank you very much for joining me. What's Romanian for thank you?
Mulțumesc. Mulțumesc.
Mulțumesc.
Yes, beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.